Stunned silence.
What is this?
A bit of a say.
So you must be doing something, right?
And explain this, that's it.
Tell us what you mean.
I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm.
Cool.
You're tuned to 15 Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 131 for September 2018. I'm your host, James, and in the virtual rendition studios today, we have Gavin. How are you, Gavin?
Good, thanks, James. It's today, tonight, tomorrow, everywhere, somebody.
That's the power of the internet. People can listen to this podcast whenever it suits them, and they will hear the dulcet tones of Anna. How are you, Anna?
I'm well, thanks, James.
Lovely to talk to you both. How are you? You all well over there in Australia?
It's starting to warm up, which is nice.
Lovely.
And no more negative degrees in the morning, so yes. It's nice.
Good. Yeah. Good. It's funny.
I was
sending someone an email the other day, and I was saying, you know, we're trying to coordinate time zones, and I was saying, you know, NZ ST, you know, standard time, and I was like, oh, soon will be NZDT for daylight savings, because we do that at the end of September. So spring is here. Feels like it's starting to make its presence known. I think my kids are off to the beach today, so you know, we'll get in there.
What?
I know.
Right? Come on.
I don't think they'll go swimming or anything, but at least they'll go down and look at the water.
Yeah. New Zealand is a hardy bunch, aren't they?
They are. Definitely us Aucklanders. That's what we're known for, is being a hardy bunch. Right. There's no real way to segue into this first topic, and there's going to be a few on this topic, but let's start with this from the Associated Press. Pope Francis is summoning the presidents of every bishop's conference around the world for a February summit to discuss preventing clergy sex abuse and protecting children. Evidence he realizes the scandal is global, and that inaction threatens to undermine his legacy. Francis's key cardinal advisors announced the decision on Wednesday, a day before Francis met with the US church leaders who have been discredited anew by the latest accusations in the Catholic Church's decades-long sex abuse and cover-up scandal. The February 21st to 24th meeting next year of the presidents of the more than 100 bishops' conferences is believed to be the first of its kind and signals a realization at the highest levels of the church that clergy sex abuse is a global problem and not restricted to the Anglo-Saxon world, as many church leaders have long tried to insist. Earlier this year, Francis faced what was then the worst crisis of his papacy when he repeatedly discredited victims of a notorious Chilean predator priest. He eventually admitted to grave errors in judgment and has taken steps to make amends, sanction guilty bishops, and remake the Chilean episcopacy, which he has accused of helping to fuel a, quote, culture of cover-up. The Vatican in 2011 ordered every bishops' conference around the world to develop written guidelines to prevent abuse of minors and vulnerable adults. The Vatican said that the guidelines should specify how bishops should tend to victims, punish offenders, and keep pedophiles out of the priesthood. Well, guys, it's been a pretty tough month, I have to say, to be Catholic. As when we last recorded last month's episode, I don't think the Pennsylvania report had been out yet, Gavin. I think it came out a couple of days later.
Yeah, so Pennsylvania wasn't out. We were discussing Cardinal McCarrick and Archbishop Wilson last month.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So obviously subsequent to that, it's now old news, but new news for the 15th Station recording has been the Pennsylvania report, and then there have been the subsequent discussions around that, and then all the different aspects on that, and then the expectation that there's going to be more reports coming from more dioceses in the US, and then, of course, now the Pope announcing this summit, which, you know, I would question the urgency given it's, you know, February next, you know, 6 months away is not exactly what I would classify as super urgent. I get the fact that everyone's busy and hard to move around, but I cannot see how there could be anything more important than this. This is not a, to quote one, was he an archbishop? Not a rabbit hole that needs to, you know, be ignored while we focus on climate change and whatever else the guy said. But anyway, I digress. I don't really. It's totally related to the topic. Gavin, what did you make of the Pope announcing this? I mean, it is unprecedented, especially for non-liturgical reasons, as far as I know, to bring all the presidents of the bishops' conferences from around the world together. What do you make of this?
I sort of would echo your sentiments, James, that it's that it seems a good idea, but, you know, I would There's a synod of bishops in Rome on young people next month. I think it starts on about the 3rd of October. There might have been an opportunity to try and hold this summit, say, the last week of September, to try and, I mean, there will be many bishops there, but not many of them necessarily will be presidents of conferences, so it's not necessarily the same people would have been in Rome. But I think the issue, given its prominence at the moment, you've mentioned a few things, James, Cardinal Vigano, or Vigano, depending on your pronunciation, that sort of scandal is bubbling away as well in terms of what Pope Francis knew when about Cardinal McCarrick and other popes for that matter. So there are these various things bubbling along, and I think I'd share the view that waiting till February is not really good enough. I'm not sure what a president of a bishops' conference would have emailed back or sent a fax back to the Vatican and said, "Sorry, I can't make it in the last week of September. I've got confirmations or something."
So, what is the possible end to that sentence that is in any way justifiable?
Yeah, so I would have. No one asked me, which is a bit disappointing, but I had sort of spoken about maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, the need for a meeting of this type and for it to be called, more or less immediately. And here we are with the meeting, but certainly not anything immediate. And obviously the text that you read was pretty loaded from the Associated Press. And it's the nature of the dealing with the scandal at the moment that the church is under massive pressure, and most of it of its own making, or all of it of its own making to one extent or another. I wish the meeting was sooner, and I wish it was, and if he called every bishop to Rome, I wouldn't have necessarily, I'm not sure there's anywhere that can handle them now. There's so many more bishops than there were in Vatican II. But if every bishop was called to Rome, I wouldn't have been.
That's a good point. In fact, when I first heard about this through the secular press, I actually mistakenly thought it was every bishop, and I was like, "Well, that is massive," because I was thinking it's on the verge of Vatican III in effect. But I think that there's something about this. Well, I don't know, Anna. I don't know if you call it. I don't know if crisis does it justice. When the Pennsylvania broke, and then the subsequent, the Vigano testimony and everything that's kind of carried on in the last, it feels like ages ago since we last spoke, but it's only been 4 weeks. And to have us in the situation where, as I've said time and time and time again on this podcast, we're going to have to keep talking about this, because this podcast is about talking about the Catholic news, and this is going to be news, what it feels like for beyond our lifetimes. But I don't know, how have things gone for you the last month with this, whether it's this story, the culmination of it, or the Pennsylvania thing? What's your sort of thoughts on the whole situation?
Yeah, I found it's been I found it really difficult, actually, especially with the accusations of the Pope and some other high-ranking officials in the Vatican that, that perhaps they knew about McCarrick, and that there is perhaps a bit of a cover-up of many things happening at all levels. And I wasn't happy with how the Pope responded, and I think there's one thing, like, I think, the abuse of minors, like the child abuse, we're getting a bit more of a handle on that in the sense of putting things in place where, this might not happen anymore or less and less. But I think the real big issue at the moment is the role of the bishop, and really, like, how their abuse of power, in the sense that they might not necessarily be abusers themselves, but having some kind of boys club where you pat the other on the back and not forgive but kind of turn a blind eye to their horrendous things that they're doing, or And that's got to stop. And so part of me is I'm not feeling entirely confident that the bishops are getting together to sort this out. Mm-hmm. I'm like, because I don't have any, it's not that I think all bishops are like this, it's not true at all, but, you know, if those people who have been accused by Vigano, I really think that actually has to be taken seriously and investigated properly, because if it's not, then how can we actually trust what comes out meeting in February?
One of the things I've really struggled with, and I've sort of had a chat with a couple of people and friends on social media about, is with the Vigano, with the testimony and the letter and the 11-page letter, and, you know, for those who have been on Mars for the last 4 weeks and haven't actually heard the news, the summary of which was that the accusation from the former papal nuncio for the US was that Pope Benedict XVI put McCarrick under sanctions, similar wording to what Marcial was put under, from what I could tell, like a life of penance and prayer and taken out of public ministry. Pope, the allegation is that Pope Francis, when he came in, undid those, and there were subsequent, you know, appointments and promotions and everything else. And when Pope Francis was asked about it, he said, I'm not going to dignify with a response, like, kind of leave it to you to read carefully and make your own judgments. And I thought that was very poor. Like, I thought his media people seriously need a good uppercut on that one. You don't deflect, those who have done media training, you don't deflect a question like that. Not when you're the Pope. Not when the question that's being asked in the context that it's being asked in. I mean, it's not at the level of, as I said, what's the polite term for Muppet? The not so clever person, was he an archbishop or a bishop who said, you know, the whole thing around, oh, look, the Pope's not going to go down this rabbit hole. He's got bigger things to deal with in terms of climate change and helping.
I think it was the Cardinal Archbishop Chicago.
Yeah.
Is he Cardinal? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Then Muppet. Yeah. I mean, that was just, do you know what I mean?
That was horrendous.
That was so poor. Poor. Like, even I get the point around what he was trying to say was, you know, Pope Francis isn't going to respond to every strange allegation that comes at him. And I'm like, yeah, but this isn't a strange allegation, mate. This is not just from some, you know, hardcore protesting priest or something. This is from a former papal nuncio, for crying out loud. So if you want to give some credibility to it, and what it's forming, and this is, I guess, the thing that I'm most concerned about, Gavin, is having a chat to a few people, I've said two things. One, on that front, I'm actually looking at both of the popes, because Pope Benedict should actually say, well, this is what I did or didn't do. Just clear it off there. And secondly, Pope Francis should be saying, well, this is my response to it. But even without that happening, you're seeing this continued, if we don't say it, if we don't comment on it, if we ignore it, it'll go away, or it won't bring more further scandal to the church. The church is now so scandal ridden that, and I'm not the first person to posit this, I honestly feel like it's starting to get on the verge of a schism. Like, you could get to a point, you know, it's foreseeable in our lifetimes to see another great schism. And that would just be, totally ignoring Christ saying, let them be one, for a start. But just that's beyond scandal. Do you know what I mean? Like, now, am I being overly dramatic? I mean, the people who are positing that as a concept, is it being overly dramatic? Will the church also survive this? Or do you think there's maybe something in that if the leadership are going to continue to respond the way they are?
Well, one of my concerns, I guess you'd probably call it, is that the issue is sort of becoming a bit of a stalking horse. It's no secret that Pope Francis is in many ways a divisive figure within the church. I think it's overstated his the sense that he's this progressive pope, I think is overstated. Yeah. But certainly there is an undercurrent of that within the church. And I think this sort of battle lines have been drawn on this issue as well, like, you know, around how people respond to the allegations from Vigano often falls along the sort of party lines, if you will, of conservative or progressive in the church, terms we don't like, but are sort of proxies for the two factions in the church at the moment. And I think I've got I'm really concerned about that. The issue of cleaning up child sexual abuse and the cover-up and all of the corruption that goes along with it can't be reduced to this sort of ideological warfare, and that people say, oh, Pope Francis, you know, didn't do what he should have done, and they're using it in some ways to be a reason to beat him up because they don't like what he says about climate change or some other issue. It's a concern that I've got at the moment, that it's becoming a bit like that, and I think that the church can't allow any cracks to appear in the armour on the issue of child sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And there are many ways in which that's happening, including, you know, seeing that some places where bishops didn't do enough or didn't do anything or that sort of thing. So there's enough inconsistency in approach there that I don't think we can allow this to be brought down to the level of ideology framing the way people respond to the abuse stuff. So that's, to my mind, an issue that's running in parallel that we need to be very careful about.
Yeah, it's a really good point you make, because I think, Anna, I think, well, obviously we're all in agreement, I know, because we've talked about it in the past, that there is no bar too high in terms of the church needing to try and regain some integrity on this matter. But I guess that's this issue. The thing for me is that it seems to be getting worse, not better. So even, as you say, you know, the call that the bishops' conferences needed from 2011 to have policies in place to prevent the abuse of minors and vulnerable adults. I think we're all putting hope and faith in the fact that those policies are being implemented, and therefore the church, you know, in 50 years' time from now is being held as a paragon of, look how well they've done in terms of they're actually well below the statistically, you know, negligent numbers of people who are abusing. I mean, ideally zero, right, in terms of abuse.
Mm.
But it feels like, you know, the Pennsylvania thing was 7 out of 9 dioceses in one state. And then you go, there's another 49 states, and then there's all through Europe. And then the whole point of this story is that it's the whole way through the globe. And it just feels like, it just feels like a mounting tsunami and getting worse week by week, without getting too sort of down on this. But I mean, again, tell me, am I being overly dramatic?
This
episode just turned into my counselling session, so this is good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, perhaps, you know, after 2002 and all the controversy there, we perhaps thought, you know, the worst of it has come out, or we have a better handle on what's happened. And sure, I mean, we didn't necessarily think that child abuse was gone forever, but, you know, perhaps we thought the worst was over. But now maybe what we're experiencing is something even worse. And maybe it seems worse because of the fact that 2002 has already happened. So we feel like we've already been here, and so therefore we're still there in some respects. Although, like, things have changed since then. But I think, you know, another major issue in this is, and it's sort of perhaps the thing that was brought to light with McCarrick, is so not just the abuse of minors, but the abuse of seminarians and other adults in the church by priests and bishops.
Mm.
So technically these are consenting adults or whatever. Yeah, I mean, you know, like, they're adults and not children. But it's first of all, a problem of celibacy, you know, of bishops and priests not living out their vow of celibacy. But also, even worse than that, well, to put on top of that, it is an abuse of, you know, someone who's not in the same kind of power level as you.
Mm.
And, you know, like, so all that as well, I think that's sort of the thing that's erupting as well. And it just seems like it's really rife, and that's the problem with power, perhaps, is the corruption it manifests in lots of different ways, and some of it is with illegal or illicit sexual relationships, and I think that's that's another reason why I sort of feel like, I don't know if we can, you know, we have to somehow hold the bishops to some kind of account, not for them to hold each other to account, because they haven't done a great job, except for, well, I mean, there have been some bishops that are whistleblowers, so to speak. And what happens? Well, we've seen in our recent history with Vigano, like his whole, he gets attacked for it. And if he'd been a victim, that would have been horrendous. Like, and they, and the church has done that in the past, right? A victim's accused someone, and basically what they've done is they've just basically said, well, this person is not a credible witness for whatever reason. And that's what they're saying about Vigano. And part of me just kind of goes, you know what? So what? So what if he hasn't, I mean, I don't know him from a bar, so I don't know what the truth is here, but we should just take any kind of allegation seriously.
Yeah. I think that's
if we're serious about this, cleaning all this area up, every accusation should be taken seriously. So this accusation against the Pope and other bishops and archbishops that are in the Vatican, part of the Secretariat of State and all that kind of stuff, like whether they're innocent or guilty, it should be taken seriously.
Absolutely right. I mean, I think you're 100% right. And actually, our next story is talking about how important it is to take these things seriously. This is from the Catholic Leader. Catholic leaders today, this is on the 31st of August, announced that they accept 98% of the recommendations of the Royal Commission into child sexual abuse and have vowed that the Church's shameful history will never be repeated. Catholic Religious Australia President Josephite Sister Monica Kavanagh and the Australian Bishops' Conference President Archbishop Mark Coleridge spoke at a media conference in Sydney, expressing their deep sorrow that vulnerable children were abused, weren't believed, and weren't supported when seeking justice. Archbishop Coleridge said the one Royal Commission recommendation the bishops would not accept concerned the seal of the Sacrament of Penance, since to accept it would be contrary to our sense of faith and would corrode religious freedom. Australian priests and the lay faithful are deeply committed to both child safety and the seal of confession, which we hold to be inviolable, he told reporters. Sister Kavanagh said the Royal Commission was an important and necessary period for the Australian community and expressed gratitude to the survivors whose courage in coming forward and telling their stories will mean that the church and society will be safer in the future, end quote. She also spoke of a shameful history of church abuse, and the cover-ups, the stonewalling, and attempts to avoid justice. Quote, the Catholic Church's shameful history and the crimes of hundreds of priests, brothers and sisters and lay people were exposed, she said. We as a church have said sorry before, and we will continue to say we are sorry, but we know that sorrow and contrition are not enough. Visible actions are now required. Sister Kavanagh said the process was already underway to reform the church's practices to ensure that safeguarding was integral in ministry and outreach to the community. Quote, making the church a safer place for our children and vulnerable persons is at the heart of our commitment to mission, she said. Gavin, I think we talked a little bit in the past when the Royal Commission was first published their reports about the seal of confession, and we talked a bit about that one breaking, but the misunderstanding of what the seal meant and et cetera, et cetera. But to at least come out and say, you know, 98% of the recommendations and the only one is the one around breaking the seal of confession, something which they can't do, I think that's positive, yes.
Well, I would say so. I'm reasonably close to the story.
When I say positive, so, I suppose it's the least worst outcome.
and I think it was interesting to see the coverage. You know, a lot of people focused on the rejection of confessional changes to the confessional seal, which. As my background as a journalist, I'm thinking about news value, you know, considering it had been said about 1,000 times that the church was not going to budge on the issue of confession, it was interesting how it dominated the coverage on the day, but that's okay. A very comprehensive report and response to the Royal Commission, in which a lot of issues were supported and accepted, and some of the issues related to issues of universal church practice, so those have been referred to the Vatican to be considered. A lot of work, I mean, just sort of reflecting on the last story, I was going to sort of mention something, but we sort of went for a long, long time on that topic anyway. But one of the things I think we're finding is that morale, our faith in the church is being shaken. A lot of the issues that we're dealing with are actually issues that are genuinely historical, which is what the Royal Commission did as well, looked at issues that for the church mostly took place between the 1940s and 2000. The stuff in Pennsylvania similarly went back decades. So there are certainly issues to be dealt with now, and the Royal Commission in Australia and other inquiries around the world will help to ensure that the things that happened then never happen again. But I think there's also a sense in which a lot of work has been done in many places, and the stories that are really making us question our bishops and our priests and popes and cardinals often relate to issues that go back decades. So I think sometimes we read the stories and we feel like on the weekend at Sunday Mass, children were abused by priests. Maybe not us, but other people, I think, read it that way. Please God, that's not the case, and we're pretty confident that it's not. But one of the things the Royal Commission was about was making sure things never happen again, and the Church in Australia and elsewhere has already done a lot. And I think that was part of what came through the response from the bishops and the religious orders, was how much has already been done, and how that is the catalyst for more that needs to continue to be done to make sure it never happens again. So,
yeah, it feels like, I mean, in business, Anna, you would call this continuous improvement. You'd feel like it's not something that ever has an end. It just is constantly expecting, no matter how much you do, you're going to expect it to be doing more and constantly trying to find ways. I mean, I think it's, what is that, you know, vigilance is the price of internal freedom or something. So it's something like that. I forget some quote. Same thing in this. It feels like eternal vigilance is the price of freedom, I think is the quote. Same thing here, right? This is going to be constant and eternal in every single church. This is obviously very local, with it being the Australian Royal Commission. But you would expect that those recommendations, I would think you'd want to spread them globally.
Well, yeah. And I mean, for all its faults, like, I mean, I guess the Royal Commission wasn't the most perfect thing. And, you know, perhaps they had a real focus on the Catholic Church and not enough on others or whatever. I don't know. There's that kind of argument. But at the same time, what is good, I think, about it is that at least this is from outside the church. It has an air of independence about it, even though it's probably not completely unbiased or something like that. But there is certainly I feel like, you know, taking those things on board and basically accepting them, you know, like 98%, you know, just shows that the church is willing to take seriously all the recommendations, the, you know, what sort of the wider church, but also the wider country of Australia, you know, has recommended. And so, you know, I think that's good. You kind of get the sense that, you know, it's not just the church going, oh, we're going to do this and that. You know, it's something wider than that. And I think that's good. And I mean, I'm glad, I mean, the whole issue of the seal of confession, I mean, there's no sort of real evidence that breaking it is actually going to help in child abuse. So, you know, we need to focus on the things that really will be useful in that area, efficient and effective and all that. So I think in some ways it's really positive that this experience has been positive, even though it's been hard. It's part of something that we're going to have to continue working on. We're never going to get to a point where we're going, oh, we've done enough and we can just sit back and relax. We have to be vigilant.
Certainly some have said that, that complacency is a real danger.
And I think it was fear of it at the moment, I've got to say.
No, I think it was someone overseas. It might have been just before some of this latest round broke, but the idea that, you know, even if you look at the stats which show the massive drop-off in the prevalence of abuse, mindful that survivors often take, you know, 20 or 30 years to report their abuse, so we, again, can't be complacent about the data. But when you see the data dropping off, we can't stop and think, well, check the box, solve the problem, because we've seen the great harm that even one priest or brother or layperson
is able to do. Yeah.
And reap. So, yeah.
Yes, well, it's maybe they could have phrased the headline and said, Australian Church backs 100% of the Royal Commission's recommendations that are possible for it to implement. But anyway, well, let's move on to another not so light topic. This is from the New Zealand Herald. Former Prime Minister Sir Bill English has urged MPs to reject a bill legalising euthanasia, saying such a move would be a slippery slope. English and his wife, the Lady Mary, told MPs that killing had always been banned and it was fundamental to humanity. The bill would ask us to look the other way. That what started as permitted would become desirable and then for some an unconsented necessity, English said. That is the slippery slope, he said. Usually legislature works very hard to mitigate what would be very small risks. This would open large risks, he said. Safeguards mean nothing if there are no consequences. English said that the test for consent was poor in the proposed bill and did not meet the necessary threshold. You have to make sure no person had their life taken against their will. That's the threshold, he said. English said the conscientious objection clause did not protect doctors who oppose euthanasia, and that was repugnant. The impact on the common good is much greater than proponents would accept, he said. And I think, I mean, when someone like Sir Bill English, with his experience in politics, says a law is bad, regardless of where your political allegiances may lie, you've got to at least give some credibility to a guy who's spent that long in politics who can recognize a bad bill when he sees one. And when his wife is a doctor, I mean, it's not like these are two kind of raving, crazy people with no real context or expertise in the subject matter. I think the country should be, and the parliament should be sitting up and paying attention, don't you?
Oh, I believe so. Unfortunately, I think those who are very much pro-euthanasia aren't perhaps really willing to listen. Those who are more perhaps on that activist level as opposed to just someone who thinks it might be a good idea because they don't want to, suffer too much before they die or whatever. Or just a person who is looking at it not from an activist point of view. But, there have been so many reports come out, like doctors against this, lawmakers against this, saying that the law itself or what is written in there, what's written in the proposal is really poor, that there are loopholes galore. So this is even before sort of whether you believe in euthanasia or not. There are so many things that are wrong about this before you even get to the ideology of it as well. So
I think
it's good that he's speaking out about it, and both of them are. It's really good.
It is really good. And I think, Gavin, that's probably the point that I pick up on this the most, is that I would, the commentary has been about how poorly formatted the bill actually is. I saw Simon O'Connor saying something similar. I saw Maggie Barry saying something similar. And of course, the Senate is a political thing, right? The National, the Conservative Party, well, not that conservative, but is more likely to resist it. And the left-leaning party is more likely to promote it. But, two things. One, where they say about when Sir, I've got to used to get calling him Sir Bill. When Sir Bill said that not killing has always been, killing has always been banned, and that is fundamental to humanity. It's a bit depressing that it requires someone to actually state that and everyone go, oh yeah, that's a good point. And second, it is Dr. Mary. Like, why wasn't there any mention of the fact that Lady Mary, she's not just, Sir Bill English and his wife. You know what I mean? Like, Mary, Lady Mary has her own, she's a professional doctor herself. So it's just surprising that wasn't mentioned.
I mean, she is a very prominent GP and often speaks out on medical issues, not least in areas relating to life and so from conception to natural death. It is interesting watching the debate try to be distilled down to left versus right in terms of political parties. There's been a fair bit of discussion of euthanasia legislation in Australia, and recently some legislation was voted down, somewhat complicated, but sort of to bring it down to the lowest possible level, there was legislation that really would have allowed the Australian Capital Territory, so where Canberra is, and the Northern Territory, to legalise euthanasia. And it was a bit of a surprise that the legislation was voted down in the Senate. It was expected to possibly not pass the House of Representatives, but it lost in the Senate. And so a number of people who would have been from sort of the Labor, the more progressive side of politics, voted against it. The former Labor Prime Minister, atheist Julia Gillard, talked about legislation and her concerns around any euthanasia legislation and its inability to protect against, as Sir Bill said, the one case in which someone who didn't seek it, she doesn't know how you can actually write legislation to avoid that, and the damage caused by that is too great a risk for her as a progressive in a political sense and an atheist. So I think when you hear that sort of concern being expressed by people who don't bring some of the faith perspectives that we do, I think that should be a great cause for concern. And certainly when medical doctors talk about, things like this is going to make us basically abandon the Hippocratic Oath, by saying, that one of our tasks now for some doctors would be to support people to end their lives. And then if you take that step to not have sufficient safeguards in place that doctors with conscientious objection can refuse to do so, adds another layer of madness to legislation. So this will continue to be a debate that rages in New Zealand, certainly in several states of Australia. It continues to be a big issue. So it's interesting seeing there has been this sense of inevitability from some people that euthanasia will be passed. It's, this is what civil societies do. They allow people to make their own choices. But it's been a very, very slow evolution. There are still very, very few jurisdictions in the world that allow euthanasia. And I think part of that's the proof's in the pudding, having seen overseas where the slippery slope has indeed been slippery.
Yeah, exactly. And it is one of those things where, it is a deliberately high burden of proof that this for the value of such legislation. When you're talking about something like this, it's not a matter of something that you can undo these kind of mistakes. So hear, hear to Sir Bill and Lady Mary and everyone else who was trying to make this ridiculous bill go away. Speaking of going away, this is from the NZ Catholic. The number of marriages declared null by the New Zealand Tribunal of the Catholic Church in 2017 as a figure in 2015. Has it more than doubled, Gavin? I thought you said we changed it out. Anyway.
Oh, no, we took out the numbers.
Oh, okay, because the numbers weren't quite right. Okay, sorry. Let's start that again. The number of marriages declared null by the New Zealand Tribunal of the Catholic Church more than doubled in 2017 as against the figure in 2015, which was largely before Pope Francis simplified the process and the New Zealand Catholic bishops decided to provide the service for free. Judicial Vicar Monsignor Brendan Daly, however, warned against making any kind of assumptions based on these figures. Quote, clearly providing the tribunal services free has had a big impact on the number of cases being processed, he said. However, we have to be careful about drawing conclusions because the reality is, in New Zealand, fewer people have been getting married since the 1970s, and so that has an impact on the number of people applying for declarations of nullity. He noted that in the early 2000s, the tribunal had been processing around 90 cases a year. This number dropped in half when the NZCBC's Finance Committee increased the charges for processing the declaration of marriage nullity cases from $900 to $2,000. One would think that more people would apply for declarations of nullity when the process was simplified and made free, but Monsignor Daly said the reality is more complicated than that. Quote, you've got a lower number of white New Zealanders getting married, and you've also got many immigrants coming into the country, he said. There are a lot fewer cases of white people wanting declarations of nullity in the tribunal, but more immigrants are seeking declarations of nullity. So we're not supposed to draw any conclusions from these numbers, Gavin, but so we don't have the numbers in there. but we can still draw about the increase in... Well, no, we're not supposed to do that either. Okay, well, let's not even talk about the story then. I mean, $900 to $2,000 and then dropping it from $2,000 to free is going to have some sort of impact, just basic economics. But we are seeing an increase, a net increase in the number of people who are asking to have their marriages annulled. Anna, that is not a good thing, is it?
Well,
can we even say that though? See, this is maybe this is just a story where we go, there you go, there's the facts, and move on.
Boo.
Boo.
Well, you know, what kind of came to mind was more the fact that maybe less people are getting married, but more people who are getting married in conditions where they can get an annulment afterwards. So they're both entering into a marriage when they shouldn't.
Hmm.
And I guess that's a sign of the times as well, to some degree.
Tricky. It's one of those things where, I mean, we've talked about annulments before, Gavin. I mean, they are kind of complicated to explain. But, I mean, what did you make of the story, even with Monsignor Daly saying, don't draw any assumptions?
Well, you
can make assumptions, don't draw any conclusions.
Yeah, I always find this, the issue of annulments, quite a fascinating one. Maybe that's why I chose to put it in, and maybe it was a poor story choice. But I do find it an interesting topic to look at how the church is responding to people in ways that, you know, it's all overlaid on the debate on divorce and remarried overlays on this very clearly, and access to sacraments generally. There has been, I know overseas, there have been discussion about whether it's become a little too easy to receive an annulment. I'm not saying that's necessarily the case in New Zealand, because we can't draw any conclusions. I think people often misunderstand what annulments are about, and declarations of nullity, and just the general inquiry process around one's marriage. So I think it's some, you know, and I don't really know what to think.
we can move on, but I do think it's one of those things where, you know, something that at least they're keeping the statistics on it. It feels like there could be a better analysis done on this, in terms of there's a lot of comments that Monsignor Daly is making about immigrants versus people born in New Zealand, and I don't know, maybe they need to do a little bit more research and see if it's a trend other than just an increase in numbers. Give some new life to those figures. Speaking of giving something new life, from the Associated Press, a 14th century church in the Czech Republic that was once in ruins is getting a new life from tourists who want to see the eerie visitors from beyond the grave. In 2012, art student Jacob Hadrava used St. George's Church in the village of Lukova as the canvas for his senior arts thesis. He filled the Catholic Church's pews with ghostly figures made from plaster casts of live models draped in white cloth. The effect is chilling, says the Associated Press. He called the work My Mind. Ooh. Word got out about the ghost church of the Czech Republic, and in 2013, a videographer published a stylized YouTube video featuring creepy music and movie effects. It was a hit and has almost 200,000 views. The church fell into disrepair after World War II, when the ethnic German parishioners were expelled by the Czechs. The church kept deteriorating through the late 1960s and was abandoned after pieces of the ceiling began to fall during a funeral. Curiosity about the installation has been building, and there is now a website and mentions on travel websites. The church is open to the public on Saturday afternoons, when around 150 people come to see the ghosts. A mass is held annually in April at the Ghost Church, to celebrate St. George's Day. The pictures online show the pews are packed on that day with both the living and the quote-unquote dead.
The dead.
The dead. Scare quotes around dead, which is kind of appropriate. They're kind of spooky, the photos. We'll put a link up in the show notes, Gavin, to the Herald article.
Light story this month is...
Yeah, it's very...
heavy.
I don't know. So the church is still used as a church. So it obviously hasn't been deconsecrated, because they have a mass there once a year. But, I guess you can still deconsecrate and have mass there. But it's a bit, I don't know, turning a church into a little bit of an art exhibit, isn't that not really what we normally do, is it?
It depends what you... Didn't they have a fashion show somewhere in New York or something?
Was that in a Catholic church? Do you often have them in... I've seen them in Anglican and other churches, but I haven't seen them in ours. I don't know.
I think it wasn't there in a Catholic one.
I don't know.
Yeah. They got a new roof in 2017 that came from donations that the spooky spectres have brought in by visitors easy to take selfies and shoot video with them. I mean, I guess with stories like this, I mean, if you're a reporter at the AP and a story like this comes across your desk, you're like, yeah, go on. be something a bit different.
Sign me up.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a bit of a tradition of, you know, our sort of thoughts on death and all that kind of stuff is, you know, like our having incorrupt bodies sort of in churches where you can go and see them, and even the bone church in Rome that has all those, so in the crypt they have a whole lot of shrines, and it's a Franciscan Capuchin church, and they have a dirt floor where when the Capuchins die, they get buried there. And then when they run out of space in the dirt, they dig up the bodies, or they're just bones, and then they put the bones on the walls. So, you know, I mean...
You remind me not to go there.
Yeah,
so I kind of think it's a bit... okay, they're doing a little bit of a gimmicky thing, right? But the idea of... sort of ghosts or whatever in a church is a little bit of a gimmick, and especially like with the, you know, the looking like they've got sheets over them and stuff like that. But like, we do have kind of this thing of connection with those who are dead, and a relationship with their remains as well, like, you know, especially of saints and all that kind of stuff.
Relics, yeah, the relics is a good point, actually, Anna. Yep. Very good point.
Yeah.
I was not going anywhere near that.
I didn't think you were, but once again, Anna, once again, brings another level to the analysis and discussion.
It's like, it's a bit creepy, was about my analysis.
Well, I think it's a bit creepy because I've got this, you know, like silly, like,
you just,
what do you call it?
Yeah, like
cartoony kind of ghosts going on.
Yeah, Gavin was just going for a story about spooky spectres on Station 15. I like the alliteration. Okay.
I do like alliteration.
If you're a fan of alliteration, you can go through our previous episodes, because Gavin usually does a wonderful job coming up with at least some alliteration, sometimes some assonance as well in the titles of our shows. And you can go check them all out at www.station15.co.nz. You can subscribe for free on iTunes or Google Play or pretty much anywhere good podcasts are found. Just search for The 15th Station. And if you'd like to send us an email, we'd love to hear from you at podcast@station15.co.nz or twitter.com/station15 or facebook.com/station15. Thank you very much, Anna. It's a bit of a down show, this one, but I mean, it's serious stuff and it's good to cover them off with someone like yourself. Thank you for making the time.
Oh, you're welcome. It's good to be here. I think I say that every time, but it is.
Well, it's always good to have you, and it's always good to have you too, Gavin. Thank you for your work getting the show together today. It's good to sort of cover off some of these topics and steer straight into them. We have to do that.
Yeah. It would be often be easier just to sit by and find all of the fun stories of the church, but covering the church warts and all is what we try to do.
It is,
and
indeed.
Sometimes the warts are very visible.
It is indeed. And I think that's probably something which we'd call out to everyone listening to the to this podcast. You know, there's been calls from a number of leaders in the church and leaders outside the church to obviously pray for the church, but also to pray that we as a church get the guidance we need to really tackle and address this. You know, the issue that we've been talking about for what feels like years now, and probably will still be talking about for years. But anyway, we hope that you've enjoyed the show, and we hope that we'll talk to you next month. But until then, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.